Hello, everyone. I think we're ready to get started now. My name is Elizabeth McCandless. I'm the Director and Legal Counsel at the Manitoba Law Reform Commission and a member of the executive of the legal research section. And so thank you all for taking part in today's session on researching American law. Just a reminder to those of you who are taking part by phone to keep your phone muted throughout the duration of the presentation. You can press star 6 to mute, and we'll be saving some time at the end of the presentation for questions. So if you need to ask a question later, it's star 7 to unmute. I'm pleased to introduce our presenter for today's session, Kim Clark. When we had the idea for this session, we were hoping we could find someone who could bring a Canadian perspective to researching Canadian law. So we were thrilled that Kim agreed to be our speaker. She not only provides a Canadian perspective, but actually a Manitoba perspective, since she started her legal career in Manitoba before going elsewhere. Kim Clark is the head of the Bennett Jones Law Library and an adjunct professor of law at the University of Calgary. She obtained her LLB from the University of Manitoba in 1989 and her Master's of Library and Information Studies degree from the University of Alberta in 1997. Kim articled and practiced with Thompson Dorfman Swetman in Winnipeg before serving as a legal analyst with the Manitoba Law Reform Commission. Upon graduating with her Master's in Library Studies degree, Kim worked at the Ohio State University and then at the University of Pacific's McGeorge School of Law, where she was the Assistant Dean for Library and Research Services. She has taught introductory and advanced legal research courses at universities in both Canada and the United States over the past 19 years, so she brings a wealth of knowledge on this topic. So without further ado, I will pass it over to Kim. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. First, I want to apologize, but I came down with a cough and a sore throat yesterday, so my voice is a little scratchy, and I will be taking probably frequent breaks to sip some water. Hopefully I won't be coughing very much, but I think my voice is a little scratchy. So in this presentation, I'm going to be, of course, showing you where you can find the resources that I'm going to be speaking about, but I'm also going to be discussing some unique aspects of the American legal system and some unique American legal resources as well to hopefully help you understand what their purposes are and why you would want to use them. So I'm going to start off by showing you the three primary databases I'm going to be talking about are QuickLaw, Westlaw, and Hine Online. And throughout the presentation, I'll also show you a few websites that you can also use to find the resources. But I'm going to start off by showing you how you can access the American material on QuickLaw, Westlaw, and Hine Online. Now, we have already converted over to the new QuickLaw, the Lexis Advanced QuickLaw. So if you have done so as well, I'll be showing you the steps, and I'll also explain how on the old QuickLaw you can find the American material as well. So this is, for those of you who haven't seen the new Lexis Advanced QuickLaw, this is what it looks like. And to find the American material, you click down here where it says See Available Resources in English. And what comes up is this list of the different international databases that they have or collections that they have. Even though it's called international, for the most part, they are foreign material. So they are the material from foreign countries. They're not really international law. I clicked on the international commentary because I wanted to see what commentary or secondary sources they had available, and I was a bit disconcerted to see that there was actually no secondary sources available there. So this is the international commentary page that came up, but when you clicked on sources, there was nothing there. So what I did was I clicked on where it says browse sources, and this actually takes you to the old source directory. So if you are still on the old QuickLaw, if you click on the source directory tab, that's going to be the next page that you see here. So I clicked on browse sources. Oh, shoot, I forgot. I keep having to remember to click the arrow. It's not like PowerPoint. Sorry. But you'll see that what comes up is exactly what you see if you click on that source directory tab in the old QuickLaw. So the default is going to be Canada, and the folders down here are all the Canadian materials. To change to the U.S., all you have to do is click the down arrow and then select United States is what you would have to do. Westlaw is a little bit easier. From Westlaw Next Canada, all you have to do is click on the International tab, and then Westlaw Next United States pops up. Underneath, you've got the British and the Australian materials underneath as well. But that's one step, essentially, and you can get into the American material on Westlaw. Hine Online is even easier. If you click on Hine Online, on their homepage, on their main page, you see all of their libraries or collections that they have, and many of them are going to be the American material, so you just have to click on the resource that you're interested in searching. So I am now going to be talking about the different types of materials. I'm breaking it down by secondary sources, and then I will be talking about the primary materials as well, so the statutes, the regulations, and the cases. So in terms of American secondary sources, we have the same usual suspects. We have the legal encyclopedias, articles, and books, of course. The two national legal encyclopedias that are available are called American Jurisprudence Second and Corpus Juris Secundum. So we've got AMJUR and CJS. Both of them are available on Westlaw. AMJUR also used to be available on Lexis, but it isn't any longer because it's actually produced by West. So West made them pull it a few years ago. But they're both available on Westlaw. But there's also two unique American secondary sources that a lot of people, or many people, aren't sure of their purpose or why you might want to use them. And those are the Restatements of Law and the American Law Reports, also just known as ALR. So I'm going to talk about each. So the Restatements of Law are a highly persuasive secondary source. Judges pay attention to what the restatements say about the law. The restatements provide a very short statement of the law. It is actually called the black letter of the law because it is so short and so succinct, and is a little summary just of what the law is or should be. The restatements are only in the common law subjects. So if it is a statutory issue, it's not going to be dealt with by the restatements. And the restatements, their whole purpose is to shine a light on what the case law says. Or if there's two conflicting lines of cases, the restatement actually tells you which line of cases they feel is correct. And so they will actually choose one line of cases over another. And the reason that they get away with it and that the judges actually pay attention to what is said in the restatement is due to both the publisher and the process that the restatements go through in their creation. The restatements are published by the American Law Institute. The American Law Institute is one of the most prestigious legal associations or organizations in America. In order to be a member, you actually have to be invited to join the ALI, and they only invite experts in the field. So the judges know that every single member is an eminent lawyer who specializes in a particular area of law. And so what happens with these restatements is the ALI will ask for one of their members to actually read all the cases and determine what the law is or should be. And so this eminent member of the ALI will read all of this and will write this succinct statement of law as well as an explanation as to how he or she arose with this or came up with this determination of what the statement should be. That draft restatement, that draft statement of law, then goes to every single member of the ALI. So the judges know that who get to comment and get to say whether they agree or disagree, and it goes through this whole debate and discussion. So the judges know that it's not just one expert saying this is what the law is or should be, but every single member of the ALI has had a say and has participated in this debate over this statement of law. So it is even more persuasive than law review articles where there might be one eminent scholar or two that are writing on this subject. But here there are hundreds of lawyers who have reviewed this. So the restatement has a very short statement of law, usually one sentence, sometimes two, but usually just one sentence statement of law. Then we've got an explanation in the comments field. Then the reporter, that's the member who actually wrote the restatement, gives a history on the whole legal principle so you can see how they developed. And then they also list all the cases that the reporter considered in developing this restatement. And these are available on Westlaw. The ALRs, the American Law Reports, its title, American Law Reports, makes you think that it is a case reporter, and it is sort of, I call it a hybrid between a primary material and a secondary source, because it does contain a few full-text cases, one case per article. But the article itself is the most important component because the article, again, looks at areas of law where there are two lines of cases or there hasn't been a consensus on what the law should be, and it summarizes all the cases so that you can see very clearly what courts are, how the courts are leaning. So, you know, the Third Circuit Court might be leaning in one direction and the Fifth Circuit might be going in another direction. And they summarize it all for you so that you can get an overview of how the courts in the various jurisdictions in the U.S. View this particular legal issue. So what happens here is the editor for West, the editor will just look at a federal appellate decisions on issues where the Supreme Court has not made any determination, and on issues where not all the appellate courts are in agreement. So there are two lines of cases at the federal appellate level, and the editor will one case comes across their desk for whatever reason, they then will do research and find all the appellate level decisions and will write the article summarizing the law. Unlike the restatement, the editor for the ALR, the person writing the article, does not take a position. They simply are summarizing what the different courts are saying on these issues. So it provides a great overview without saying one way or the other which is the more appropriate position. These are also available on Westlaw. So in order to find both the restatements and ALR on Westlaw and all the other secondary sources, after you click the International tab, you just have to click on Secondary Sources. And you'll see that up here we've got the American Law Reports, we've got the restatements in the middle of the second column here, we've got Black's Law Dictionary over in the right, we've got the Law Reviews and Journals database. The encyclopedias are actually listed under the texts and treatises, and the books are both going to be under texts and treatises as well as Walter Kluwer. Now, what materials you're going to have access to will depend on your subscription, of course. A lot of the books, at least with our subscription, a lot of the books we don't have access to the full text. And of course, many of these books are going to be practitioner focused rather than scholarly, which is what you might actually want, especially the Walter Kluwer material, which are the CCH materials. So if you think about the CCH materials that we have here in Canada, they're going to be very similar down there. So a lot of guides, a lot of handbooks, checklists, things that could be very helpful if your firm was actually interested in something or involved in a case that's taking part in the U.S. So I clicked on Law Reviews and Journals here, and then on the little eye, the little scope note, because I wanted to show you that the Law Reviews and Journals database has all the American law journals as well as the Canadian law journals. This is actually the largest law review database on Westlaw. So if you want to search for all the potential law review articles on your subject, this is the database that you should use. Now, with the Canadian materials, at least with our academic subscription, they're listed, but when you go to click on the full text, it will actually say, go back to Westlaw Next Canada for the full text. And that just happened this past year. Prior to that, the full text was there. But at least you can see what articles come up in your search, and then you can go back to Westlaw Next Canada and print out the full text. One Canadian law review that is not on Westlaw is actually the Alberta Law Review, and that's because Westlaw and the Alberta Law Review could not agree on how much money the ALR might get for it. So it is not on it's not on Westlaw, unfortunately. So here is the restatement, and you'll see that these are the areas of law that are covered by the restatement. So you could just click on a particular area if you're interested in employment law, for example, and then just expand it and see what legal issues are discussed. Of course, at the top of the page, there's also the big search box that you can do your search in. So I had gone into torts, and I'm looking at the issue of negligence here. So you'll see that it's got a little table of contents at the top of the page. So it tells you that there's going to be a comment, reporter's notes, and then the case citations. Those are the cases that the reporter considered when writing this restatement. And you'll see that this is the restatement itself. This is one sentence, succinct statement of law. Underneath that, you will then get the comment, which provides an explanation as to how the reporter came up with that statement. And then underneath that, you get the reporter's notes, which provide the history or the background, how this principle has developed over time. Underneath that, you would then find the cases that the reporter considered. But I wanted to point out that you can also note up your restatement entries, so you can see what cases, what courts have considered this restatement principle, and whether they've agreed with it or whether they've cast doubt on it, how has it been treated by the courts, which of course helps you know just how much you can rely on it. The American Law Reports, again, they do have the subdivision in terms of different subjects, but again, you can do the big box search at the top of the page if you wish to search all of them. There's actually a lot more topics than this. I when I looked at this, I couldn't understand how they just came up with these few topics, because they write ALR articles on a wide range of topics. The ALR, there's multiple series of it, you know, just like with the case reporters, if there's too many volumes, they produce a new series. And so there's multiple series of the ALR. It's been around for quite a while. And if you might actually find multiple ALR articles on the very same issue. So they will sometimes look at an ALR article that they did, let's say, 20 years ago, and they will update it to see how the courts have handled it in the past 20 years to make sure that you can always get current information. Again, here is what the ALR article looks like. And again, you can note it up, so you see that at the top. The table of authorities are the cases that the author of the article relied on, and the citing references, again, are going to be those cases and secondary sources that have actually referred to this ALR on annotation. And I wanted to point out that on the right-hand side of the American version of Westlaw, they often will put in related materials that's on the same subject, thinking that you might also want to take a look at them. So you'll see that the ALR article simply starts off with an article, with an explanation, an introduction to the topic itself, and then you get this outline. So you can just click on the particular sub-issue that you're interested in if you wish. And if you do so, you'll see a little introduction again to the topic. And then they simply will summarize all of the cases that have been that have considered this point. And they tell you very clearly what court these cases are from. So if you were interested in a particular court, you could scroll through and see if your court has considered this issue as well. So to find U.S. secondary sources on Quick Law after changing my country to the U.S., there are two different folders that I would be interested in. One's going to be commentary. The other will be legal journals. There's very little commentary or secondary sources other than law review articles on Quick Law, unfortunately. So you can see the limit, the limited amount that's here. There are, though, hundreds of law review articles, and some of them are going to be the individual journals themselves. So you'll see that we've got the ABA Family Law Quarterly, for example. Some of them are going to be topical arrangements. So here are all the ADR law review articles are combined. So you can use one of these topical combinations to focus just on the particular issue that you're interested in. And others are going to be geographical. So you see here that we've got all the Arkansas law reviews, for example. Now, one of the issues that I've got with using the geographical law reviews is that sometimes even an article relating to Arkansas law might actually be published in a Mississippi law review, you know, in a nearby state, for example. So you might actually miss that if you just use this geographical combination. But the topical are excellent, and don't forget you can select more than one when you're doing your searches on Quick Law. In terms of, so I said there were hundreds of law review available. The largest collection that is on Quick Law, and let me just show you that, you see this drop-down menu at the top here? Excuse me. You have to use this drop-down menu. You can use it to scroll through, to move through those hundreds of databases, of law review databases fairly easily. It's an alphabetical order. And so to get to the largest database, law journal database on Quick Law, you would change that to the drop-down menu that allowed you to search in the L's, because it's actually called Law Review, CLE, Legal Journals, and Periodicals combined. So that is your largest law journal database on Quick Law. If you wanted to search everything, all the law reviews, that's the one that you would use there. Of course, Hine Online is known for its law reviews. So I'm sure I'm speaking to the choir here, but there are two main differences between Hine Online and their law reviews and Lexis and Westlaw. Hine Online, firstly, is in PDF rather than text only, which is on Lexis and Westlaw. And the other difference is Hine Online has tried to go back to volume one for all of their law reviews, whereas Quick Law and Westlaw, they have not done any retrospective edition. They have not added any retrospective issues of their law reviews to their collections. So if they started collecting, let's say, the University of Toronto Law Journal, they started collecting it in 1996. I mean, 1996, not even in the 80s. And they have not gone back and put the older issues in. So if you're looking for the most comprehensive collection of law reviews, starting from volume one, it's going to be Hine Online. And again, they're in PDF, so that is very beneficial. If you don't have access to Hine Online, then you could actually go to the University of Manitoba and use it on site. I'm sure that their licensing agreement allows it, as ours does here as well. So there's the Law Journal Library. which has the American, Canadian, Australian, British. So it's from common law countries primarily. I wanted to point out that they also have historical legal books in their legal classics collection. And again, it's going to depend on whether you subscribe to that collection or not. But there's some jurisprudence books and things there, like from Pound and things like that. So if you click on the Law Journal Library Collection, there's a variety of different ways of searching. If you have your citation, you can just go simply click on the letter that will, the first letter in the name of your law journal. Of course, you can also use the big box at the top. I always recommend if you're going to do full text searching that you actually click on the advanced search because it gives you more search, more options. So you've got more fields here. You can actually limit to text, or if you know the article title, if you know the author you're interested in, if you want to put a date range, so after, you know, 2003, because you know that the law changed in 2002 and you want to just find those articles dealing with the law that happened since then, you could put a date range in. You've got a lot of different different options with the advanced search rather than just using that basic search box at the top of the page. So I also clicked then on the Foreign and International Law Resources Database to show you that there are some full-text secondary sources available in some of the other collections that they have as well. So you really should take a look, just click on the title for the different database collections that you have available on HINE Online to see what is actually in that collection, because sometimes it can be surprising. And here, for example, we've got the International Yearbooks and periodicals are within the Foreign and International Law Resources Database. So just click on the title and it will show you the components of that particular collection. So now I'm going to be turning to statutes. Excuse me, turning to statutes. So the U.S. federal statutory process is very similar to here in Canada. They have two chambers just like we do. The steps in the whole process are similar. A bill is introduced in one chamber. It is sent to committee. The committee holds hearings or accepts or asks for written submissions. The committee reports back, may make changes to the bill. There's debates in the chamber. It's voted on, it goes to the other chamber, goes through the very same steps, et cetera. If it passes both chambers, then it goes to the president for signing. Now, there are a couple of things that I wanted to talk about in terms of the American process that are unique to them. So one is the president has the right to veto any act or any bill that comes to them. If the president vetoes a bill, then it goes back to both chambers and they vote again. And if it passes by a two-thirds vote, then it becomes law, notwithstanding what the president says. And in fact, if in the initial vote, if there's two-thirds of the people vote in favor of the act in the initial vote, then it is actually called veto-proof. The president couldn't veto it because two-thirds of the elected officials in the House and the Senate voted in favor of it. So that's how the veto actually works. Now, one other thing that happens quite often, more in the States than what we have here in Canada, although sometimes it happens in Canada here too, but both chambers can actually be considering bills on the very same subject at the very same time. And this often happens when there's a national incident. So if you think about Sandy Hook, for example, the shooting that happened at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, immediately afterwards, in both the House and the Senate, there was a bill introduced at some kind of there were several bills introduced in both about gun safety. So that's one thing that can happen. The other thing that can happen is, let's say a bill goes through the House, but then when it goes to the Senate doesn't like all the terms that the House put in that bill. They want changes. If either of those situations happen, where the two chambers can't agree on all the terms, they send representatives to what is called conference to actually work out the differences. And the whole purpose of conference is to have a bill that both houses are going to be able to pass. So conference, you will get a conference report where the representatives will indicate why they've made the changes that they've made, and you'll get a negotiated version of the bill, which then goes through both chambers as well. So sometimes you might have come across something that says it's a conference report, and you're scratching your head, what the heck is a conference report? And it is this negotiated agreement that they have reached in order to get a bill that might be able to go through both chambers. Excuse me, I'm going to have to have a little sip of water. So another big difference between Canada and the U.S. comes with respect to how the statute is published and what you might actually see if you're looking at the published version of the statutory section. A statute in the U.S. goes through several different publication formats. The first one is what's called the statutes at large. These are the public laws. They are the equivalent of our statutes of Canada, so just the annual statutory set. So it includes the statute as it was passed, as it was enacted, and that's the statutes at large. The abbreviation is just STAT. But that is not usually the version of the statute that lawyers use. They are going to use the codified version. So what happens after the statute's at large, after the statute gets passed, is they will look at the different components or parts, the different sections and of the statute, and they'll say, what is the real heart? What's the subject of each of these sections or each of the different parts of the statute? And they break that act up and they put it in a topical arrangement in the U.S. Code. So the U.S. Code has 50 topics, which are called titles, and these sections of the acts are pulled from the act as it was passed and put into this topical arrangement. So as you know, each statute, there could be a main theme. So let's say that we've got consumer protection. So a lot of it deals with consumer protection, but some of it might deal specifically with impact on commerce. And so some might be under consumer protection title, some might be under commerce, some might have tax consequences being discussed in the act. Those would then go under the tax title. So each act as it's passed is broken up and put into this topical arrangement. In the statutes at large, if you see the act as it's passed, quite often in the margin, you will often see a citation will say 17 USC and then the section symbol, the American section symbol, and then 1231. So it's telling you in the margin where that particular section is going to show up in the U.S. Code. So the U.S. Code is a topical arrangement, which is much more useful when you're in practice because you can focus on those topics or those titles that are applicable to your practice area, for example. It is possible that a statute will be kept in its entirety, and it usually happens if it is the first if it's the first act of its kind. So, for example, I can remember when the Electronic Signatures Act came out. It was kept almost as one part in the U.S. Code. It was kept almost together in the U.S. Code because there was nothing similar to it. And so it's under commerce, under the commerce title, and the Electronic Signatures Act was kept together. there. So it does happen periodically, but quite often it is broken up. These are both the official versions of the statute. So the U.S. Code is what you're going to refer to primarily. Sometimes if you're referring to the Act as it was passed, you would be citing to the statutes at large. So it's really going to depend on what version you need to use in your argument or in whatever you're using, whatever you're writing. So I just wanted to show you that Hine Online has both the U.S. Code as well as the statutes at large, so you can see them there. They are also available on the Government Printing Office's website. It used to be called GPO Access, and I see here I put GOP in my slide, but it's GPO, Government's Printing Office. So we've got the U.S. Code over here on the right, and where it says public and private laws, those are the statutes at large. You can also use just their search engine here in the middle of the page that will search everything, all these collections, and you can also click advanced search if you want, and again, it'll search all these collections. But their advanced search itself isn't very advanced. It's actually quite rudimentary, but that's a free website that you can access. So the U.S. Code is, the government came out with the U.S. Code, and commercial publishers said, you know what, we can make the U.S. Code even better. We can make it so that it's more useful to practitioners, and they created what's called annotated codes. So these are unofficial versions of the code, and they have the law in them, so they have the statutory sections in them, but then they've added these research aids in order to make it easier for you to find relevant regulations, secondary sources, as well as cases that have considered your section. So underneath the statutory sections, underneath each section, they actually will list these different pieces of information that might help you do your research. There are two versions of the U.S. Code. One is the United States Code Annotated, which is known as USCA. It's on Westlaw. It's published by West. The other is the U.S. Code Service, USCS, and it is on QuickLaw. It is published by Lexis. The Lexis version is better to find references to regulations. The USCA may include a regulatory reference, but you can't count on them. The USCS always has related regulations, so it's very good. Secondary sources are available on both of them. Sometimes there will be references to books. They are only going to be the books or the encyclopedias that are published by that publisher. So it's not going to be comprehensive in terms of books. Law review articles, they're fairly comprehensive. But the real find here is going to be the annotations of cases that have considered this section. And by considered, it's going to be cases that have actually analyzed or discussed the section, so not simply referred to it. So I'm starting off by showing you where you would find the USCS on QuickLaw. So again, we're in the United States materials, and we click on legislation here, and then you would click on statutes. And I went to the drop-down menu because, again, look, there's over 1,000 sources, just statutory sources in American statutory sources on QuickLaw. And that's because they've got the historical material as well. You can see that here. So if you need to know what the law was at a particular date, you've got fabulous historical material, legislative material on QuickLaw. It's actually better than on Westlaw for this. But I went to the drop-down menu. I know that I'm looking for the USCS, so I'm going to click on Tennessee because it's going to fall between Tennessee and Utah. So it's not under federal. It is under USCS, United States Code Service. And when I went there, I realized that with the changes that Westlaw has made, or that QuickLexis has made recently, they no longer just have one entry here that has all of the USCS. From here, you've got to select what title or topics it is that you are interested in searching. Now remember, you can select multiple. So for this one, for example, there are two different collections of health titles. I wasn't sure which one it might be, so I selected both of them. So you can select multiple databases and just click OK. So this is what the USCS looks like. So it tells you, here's the electronic signatures in global and national commerce. It is part of Title 15, which is Commerce and Trade. Excuse me. And it is Chapter 96. As I said, they kept this act together almost entirely, so it has its own chapter or part in Title 15. Here is the start of the section, so that is the actual law itself. This crazy little symbol, if you don't already know, that is the American section symbol, so you do not use S as we do here in Canada. It's these two S's intertwined, so one S and then the second intertwined with the first, that is section symbol. Underneath the section itself, that's where you're going to find the research aids. And so you see this heading, notes, and then it gives you Code of Federal Regulations. So it tells you here are related regulations that you might want to take a look at. Here is also some related statutory sections. So they're all, this, we were dealing with section 7001, so it's referring us to the nearby sections that also refers to section 7001. Underneath the regulatory and statutory sections, that's where we get the secondary sources. So you'll see the heading that says research guides. In this one, it's also referring you to AMJR. Remember, they used to have access to AMJR, so they are still allowed to allow you to link it through, even though you can't search it full text on Lexis. And then here's NIMR on copyright, which is published by a Lexis publisher, so Matthew Bender is owned by LexisNexis, so it's telling you that NIMR on copyright, NIMR is the leading copyright text in the States, actually discusses the Electronic Signatures Act at that section in that volume, that you can click on it as well, if it's part of your agreement, your subscription. And then underneath you get your law review articles. Again, most of them are going to be hyperlinked that you'll be able to link directly to the full text. And then underneath that you get the cases that have considered your section. And again, they've got a heading so you see very clearly that we're talking about decisions. So these are court cases that have considered your section. If there were a lot of cases, here I think there's only, I think there were only three or four. If there were a lot, you would see like a table of contents at the top here, so you could actually click on the particular issue that you're interested in and find those cases that have considered that particular issue. So in print, the USCA, so the West product, is arranged in the very same order. So we've got the section first, then you've got the secondary sources underneath. But electronically, West no longer has this arrangement. They now make it all available from the top of the page through the tabs. So here is the statute section in Westlaw, and if you just click on the U.S. code annotated right there at the top, and then you would do your search, which I did, and here again you see your section 7001 starts down there at the bottom, but now if you scroll down the whole section, there is nothing underneath the statute itself except the history note. They now have all these tabs at the top that you can click on in order to find the cases and secondary sources. So you'll see that they've got citing references, which we're used to because that's what we use for noting up in Canada as well, and they've got the history. But they also have notes of decisions, and they have it over here in the right side of the page as well as the tab at the top. The notes of decisions are those cases that would be listed underneath the section in the print version of the USCA. So these are the cases that have truly considered this section. And there's only seven. You can see that here. It says seven in the tab. Whereas under noting references, I mean, there's over 6,000 citing references, I should say, and there's 101 cases under citing references. So here it's cases that might have simply cited the section without analyzing it in any way. So there are different standards being applied by the citator editors versus the USCA editors. To be included in the notes of decision, as I said, they have to actually be discussing the application of the section. They can't just be citing the section itself. And here you can see out of those 6,000 citing references, there are 101 cases, there is 3,600 secondary sources, etc. So, I mean, it's still very helpful, but I just wanted to point out the difference between the seven here and the 101 that are listed under the citing references. Excuse me. I'm going to talk next about legislative history. Now, that is the term that is used in the states to discuss doing research on legislative intent. So why did the federal government pass this statute? And, I mean, we have some of that information here in Canada, especially at the federal level, but it is just unbelievable how much information is available for American federal statutes. And in some states as well. So I was in California for 6 years. California has a lot of information available as well in terms of what the committees are discussing and all of that. So some states might, but the federal, American federal definitely do. Most of this available information is available on Westlaw, and some of it's also available on Congress's website, congress.gov. It actually replaced the Thomas website, so if you used Thomas to do legislative history research, that information is now going to be on congress.gov. So, excuse me. So, this again are the steps that a bill goes through before it becomes law, and this is the type of information. This is the information that you're going to be looking for. Does someone have a question? Oh. This is going to be the information or the resources that you're going to look at in order to find the intent. So, the bill, you're going to be looking at the initial and all the amended versions of the bill. At the committee level, they hold hearings and they accept submissions. So the testimony at the hearings and the written submissions are all available. So let's say that your law firm is involved in a dispute, and you know that one of the corporate executives on the other side had given testimony on behalf of their company with respect to a particular bill. You can actually do research to find what that individual said regarding that bill because it might actually help your it might help you understand their perspective on things, or that you could use it against them or whatever. But that testimony is all available as well as the written submissions. The committee then publishes a bill as well as the publishes a report as well as amended version of the bill, and those are all available. The bills, of course, are debated in both chambers, just like they are here in Canada, and those verbatim discussions are in the congressional records, which is published every day. And then, of course, the president signs the act into law, and quite often the president will give a signing statement. And these signing statements are the president's way of putting his spin on why this act is so important. And sometimes it can differ from what is being said in the two chambers. George H.W. Bush, so 43rd, the son, did this a lot. He loved presidential signing statements, and it allowed him to indicate why he felt it was important and to get sort of his view out there, his words out there. So these are the types of materials that you would be looking for to show legislative intent. So here's congress.gov, and you'll see that there's links at the top for legislation, congressional record. Remember, again, that's the verbatim discussion of the on the floor, as well as committee information. So you can search all of it just by using the big search box here at the top. There are drop-down menus that you can limit to if you want. This is the advanced search page, so it allows you a lot of different options. And I wanted to point out that it goes back to 73. So, you know, we're talking 40 years of information available on a free website for you to search. This is what the legislation page looks like. The committees, so you can see all the committee proceedings. They've got videos. They've got reports that you can search. You can go to the committees' web pages themselves if you're interested. On Westlaw, this is from the statutes and court rules again. If you look over here on the right, they have a database called Legislative History. And they've got the congressional record, as you can see. They've got two different databases that have committee hearing transcripts in it. And then they've got this weird product called U.S. Code Congressional and Administrative News. It's actually known as USCAN. And, you know, you look at that heading, and it doesn't tell you what's contained in it. But if you click on it and on the scope note here, it actually explains that it has excerpts from the committee reports. It has the presidential signing statements. So that's the source that you would get the presidential signing statements. And you can also get just excerpts from the report. So they take out what they consider to be the most important. But it might not be what you consider to be the most important. So then you would have to use the congress.gov website to find the full reports. Now, doing these legislative histories can be extremely time-consuming because you have to go to all these different sources to find when your bill was discussed. So there are compiled legislative histories. So librarians, lawyers, academics, they have actually created legislative histories on different acts, and they are published often in law review articles. So what they do is they tell you every day that the bill was discussed in the particular chamber. They tell you when the hearings were held and where you can get the transcripts of the hearings, etc. So it doesn't have the full text of all of this, but it's like an index. It points out every resource that you can look at relating to your particular bill. Westlaw has some compiled histories, but Hine Online is your best source for compiled legislative histories. So here again is on Westlaw, the legislative history. We've got the Arnold and Porter legislative histories at the top here. That is a law firm that has created some. And then they also has the USGAO federal legislative histories source as well. So here's Arnold and Porter, and you can see that they have done a limited number of statutes. They've done leg history on a limited number of statutes, and a lot of the big ones, though. So again, depending on what you're looking for, you might find it here. The GAO, which is the Government Accounting Office, has created some for the older ones, so from 1921 through 1995. So for most of the public laws, they have created them that you can take a look at. Here's Hine Online. I wanted to show you that they do have a U.S. Presidential Library, which has the presidential signing statements. But this one, which is U.S. Federal Legislative History, is actually where you would go to get your compiled legislative histories. This is what the web page looks like, the database looks like. And again, a lot of different ways to search depending on the information that you have. If you have the name of the act, if you have the popular name of the act. So it's the name that the media uses a lot, you know, the Brady Handgun Act, for example. You know, that's going to be the popular name. If you've got the citation, if you know the year that it was passed, you can use you can click on public law number and use that. Or, of course, you can use the basic or the advanced search option as well. So here you can look at the drop-down menu to see all the different fields, again, depending on the information that you have available to you. So I did a search for the Brady gun handgun based on the popular name, and I received one result. So it looks like there's only one compiled legislative history, but if you actually click on that hyperlink, you'll see that there are quite a few different legislative histories on that particular bill, and they are in law reviews. Here's Santa Clara Law Review, Seton Hall Legislative Journal, etc. So then you could click on it, and it would, again, tell you all the different resources that you could look at to get the intent. Okay, so case law. The U.S. system is a little different, partly because of how strong its federal court system is. And ours here in Canada is quite weak in comparison. We don't have as many courts, and it doesn't deal with as many cases as what the American federal court system does. So if you are having to understand what level of courts the case that you're reading is from, you really need to look at that particular state, because every single state has a very different court system structure. So here's California, for example. They've got 58 counties. There are 6 appellate divisions, and they have a Supreme Court, a state Supreme Court, which is the highest state court. New York is completely different, and it is extremely confusing. But the one thing here is their highest court is their Court of Appeals. So they don't have a state Supreme Court. So if you see a Court of Appeals decision, it actually is their highest state court. But don't confuse that with the appellate division of the Supreme Court, which isn't their highest court. So you need to look at each state in order to understand what court you're actually dealing with. I mean, it's the same in Ontario. For example, like when, you know, their high court, is that a low court or a high court? You know, the BC Supreme Court, is it a low court or a high court? The students that I teach are always confused by some of those terms. So look at the state court to understand what level of court you're dealing with. So the federal court system is unique to the states, and I want to go into a bit more detail regarding it. So what they've done is they have taken the country and they have divided up into 11 different geographical regions. They are called circuits. And you have to think about, in the historical days, you know, the judges, just like the ministers, used to ride their horses and go around a circuit. And that is how this, I always think about their circuit courts, is they used to ride to all the small towns in order to hold a trial and stuff. So they've divided the country into 11 numbered regions, as well as the District of Columbia circuit and the federal circuit. They also have some courts of special jurisdictions as well. But they've got these 13 circuits. Within each of these circuits, they have trial courts, which are called district courts. Now, this gets really confusing, because there can be multiple district courts within a particular state within a circuit, and it would say the District Court of Eastern California, for example. And you would think, oh, that is a California state court. But no, it is a federal court. It is the District Court of Eastern California, but it is a federal district court in the Ninth Circuit. So it can be a bit confusing, but district courts are the trial courts. The appellate courts are called circuit courts. So again, it's the Ninth Circuit that is the appellate court, is what it's called, the Ninth Circuit. And then, of course, the Supreme Court is the highest federal court. So this is the actual geographic breakdown of these circuits. And you'll see that on the East Coast, the circuits are very small. You know, the first circuit here, the second circuit, which is New York. And then as you go further west, they are huge. They're getting very, very large. And you have to consider the fact that these circuits were created when all the population was on the East Coast and there was hardly any population over in the West. And so they created large geographic areas. And, of course, those judges had these huge areas to go around to hear their cases. They keep talking about breaking up the Ninth Circuit into a couple of different circuits, but they haven't done that yet. But you'll see that there are actually a couple of different locations of the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court even. The main one is in San Francisco, there's another one in Pasadena, and there's one up in Seattle. So they've got different locations even for the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit itself because it's so huge. But that's how the courts themselves are arranged. Quite often, this is where it gets even more confusing, is quite often the jurisdiction overlaps between whether a case can be brought in the federal court or in the state court. In Canada, our constitution is actually a bit more cleanly divided than what they have in the states. But if it touches on federal law at all, then the preemption principle states that the federal claim supersedes a state claim. So they may file a case in both the state court and the federal court, and they will proceed on their federal case first, and then if they lose, they can still proceed on their state court case. And the state case could actually be dealing with a completely different statute, for example, or a different law, and so they may actually succeed on their state claim even if their federal claim fails. So that can sometimes be confusing to people as to whether it's state or federal. The intrastate precedent, application of precedent, is the same as what we have here. So, you know, what's binding, what isn't. Same with the federal, you know, the appellate level, the circuit court is going to be binding on the district courts within that circuit, but not binding on any other circuit court or binding on district courts within a different circuit, which means that you can often have circuit courts not agreeing on an area of law. And that will often cause the Supreme Court to hear a case that comes before them if there is a difference between what the circuits are saying on a particular matter. But it gets a little confusing if the federal court is applying state law or if the state law is applying federal law. So if the federal court is applying state law, they actually are bound by how the highest state court has ruled on that issue if they have. Okay? So they will apply the law as that highest state court has described it. But state courts are not bound by how the federal courts have applied state law, of course. They might consider it, you know, and treat it with deference, but they're not bound by it in any way. Now, state courts applying federal law, of course, they are bound by the Supreme Court decisions, but not by circuit or district court. They are just required to give them substantial deference, but they are not bound by those decisions at all. So quite often, because of how many courts there are in the state, both if you consider the state and the federal, there are going to be multiple lines of cases on the same particular issue. And so, of course, the Supreme Court is going to get involved where there are these differences because they, just like the Supreme Court of Canada, want resolution. They want some consistency in the law of the land. Of course, right now, we've got a 8-member Supreme Court, and so in a situation where if there's a 4-4 decision, that case itself has no precedential value at all. That case will apply to the specific circuit where the instant case came from, but have no application to any other circuit. So we still would have a situation where there would be this dissension among the circuit courts. In order to help you figure out how the different circuits are deciding and which one is accurate, you can take a look at the restatements of law that we talked about. You can take a look at the ALR annotations or articles to see how the courts are decided. And you can look at something called the 50 state surveys. So these 50 state surveys are books or articles that experts have gone out and reviewed the law across all the 50 states and the federal court system in order to see how all the courts have decided on that particular issue. So this will help with your research to try to get a picture of what the different courts are saying on the legal issue. to find cases on QuickLaw. Again, we're under United States, and you click cases, and there are, again, hundreds of different sources. You can select a very narrow database if you know the court that you are interested in or the jurisdiction. So, for example, if we're dealing with Delaware commercial law, you could just go to the Delaware state cases if you wanted. Or you can use larger databases such as combined databases. Here, for example, is the D.C. federal and state cases combined. So if you want to search all the D.C. District of Columbia cases, you can do so. The most comprehensive case law database on QuickLaw is called Federal and State Cases Combined. So that has all the decisions from the federal and state cases. If you just want the ones from 1944, then you can use that one as well. But that's the most comprehensive case database on QuickLaw. You can note up your case. So here I've got the Grutter case from the Supreme Court. You can note it up by clicking on the noting up symbol here, the little yellow triangle, or by going to Next Steps and clicking on Shepardize. So Shepardize is a common term for noting up your case in the United States. Mr. Shepards was the first person to create a citator, and in the States, the print set is actually called Shepards. So it's just taken on his name. And it is published by Lexis, which is why it is on QuickLaw. And you'll see that it says here to shepherdize, and that simply means to note up your section. Here is the case law database on Westlaw. You'll see that your default at the top is all federal. If you want to select all the federal and state cases, you see that's not an option here. It's one or the other, but you can click on where it says all federal, and it brings up this page, and this, the all federal is the default, but you can also select where it says all states, and then hit save, and then you will be searching all the state and federal cases all at once. Or you can, if you want, again, be more selective, just like you can on QuickLaw. So depending on if it's a particular state you want to search, or a particular circuit or court level. And again, you can note up directly from the case. So they have separated out their negative treatment because many practitioners want to look at the negative treatment first to see what other courts are saying about it in a negative way, why they're distinguishing it or not following it. You can also look at the history and, of course, all the citing references. So they're all separated out. There are filings, which are court briefs and documents. It's not part of the academic subscription, so I'm not going to be talking about that. But you can check and see if you have access to the court filings on your subscription. Now, on Westlaw, underneath each of the headnotes for the case, you're going to see this little key symbol and then these numbers and words. This is essentially their digest. So it's like the Canadian abridgment that you would get on Westlaw. It's like the Canada digest that you would get in QuickLaw for Canadian cases. So you can see how this case fits into their electronic digest. And if you want more cases on dealing with this particular issue, all you have to do is click on the key number that's here, and it's called the West Key Number System. And it's just very similar to the Canadian Abridgment or Canada Digest to find more cases dealing with that particular narrow issue. Okay, so quickly with regulations, I put this little cheat sheet in at the top here saying, what are you looking for? Are you looking for current regulations? If so, then use the Code of Federal Regulations. Are you trying to determine why a regulation was created? Then you're going to be using the Federal Register. Are you looking for proposed regulations? Then you're using the Federal Register. Are you doing historical regulatory research? Then start with the Code of Federal Regulations and then go to the Federal Register as you need to. So the Federal Register is a publication that's produced several times each week, and it contains the proposed regulations as well as the final regulations when they are released. In both for the proposed and the final regulations, they give an explanation about the purpose of the proposed or final regulation. So why are they proposing it? Why did they pass it? What's important about it, etc. So you'll actually, in the final regulation, the agency often will actually respond to submissions they received as well. So you can actually see both sides of the argument or issue being discussed. So they will say, you know, so-and-so, or sometimes they don't say names, sometimes they'll just say, it was raised, you know, this argument was raised, and here's our position with respect to it. So it can be extremely helpful to understand why a regulation came into being. This is what the Federal Register looks like. So it tells you here that this is an EPA regulation. It's going to be going into the Code of Federal Regulations at Title 40 and Part 42. It is a proposed rule. So, and then it has a summary of the rule itself. And then here is where you get that background information, the explanation for why they're proposing this regulation. So you get all your background, and it can have scientific information in there. It might talk about accident rates that have happened that they have to overcome, etc. So you get a lot of information there. Here's a final rule, so notice of final policy. Again, here's the supplementary information, which is where the explanation is going to start. And you can see they've got this in-depth table of contents that sets out what they're going to be covering. And one of the really good things is where they talk about why they've made changes from the draft policy. So again, you can see the mindset of the agency as to why they've gone through the different versions of the regulation. And then here is the policy explanation underneath. So a lot of intent, a lot of information regarding intent is produced. So after the regulation is published in the Federal Register, the regulations are again codified. They can be then pulled apart and put into the Code of Federal Regulations. So it has 50 titles or subjects, just like the United States Code does, but the title numbers do not correspond to the USC at all, except for title number 26, which is Internal Revenue. So again, the regulations themselves may not be kept together as they were in their final form. They could be split apart into this subject arrangement in the CFR, but they can also be kept together. And they're more likely to than what the statutes are. So I wanted to put this in so you could see how the CFR is actually arranged, because if you are interested in the rules of a specific agency, then you can just pay attention to the title and the chapter number within that title, and it has all the rules published by that agency. If you want to go even further and are just interested in the regulations relating to a single program that agency houses, let's say it's education, and you're just interested in the No Child Left Behind program, for example, then you can just focus on that part within that chapter, within that title, and all the way down. So that is how each title within the CFR is broken down. So we've got a broad subject area, education. Then underneath it would be the chapter, would be the rules of a specific agency. So it could be Department of Education or higher education, for example. Within that, then it would be different parts based on the different functions or programs of that particular agency. And then as you go down, so you can be quite focused in your research or what you're looking at. And to find them on Westlaw, you're going to click on Regulations, and then the Code of Federal Regulations is here, and the Federal Register is over here on the right, with the federal proposed and adopted regulations current, and then the historical is there as well. Excuse me. On QuickLaw, you're going to click on Legislation, and this time you're going to click on Regulations. And then, again, you've got all the state and federal regulations there. This, again, is GPO website, and we've got the Code of Federal Regulations and the Federal Register, so it's freely available to you to research. And on Hine Online, they have both the Code of Federal Regulations and the Federal Register as well. And that is it. Any questions?
Okay, thanks, Kim. So
we'll just open it up to questions. If you're going to ask a question and you're on the phone, just remember to press star seven to unmute your phone. And we'll see if anybody here lost sight.
Thanks very much, Kim. It's Elizabeth here, and found your presentation to be really interesting as well as useful and thorough. Just to start off the questions, I just had a question about finding cases. You showed us where to find U.S. case law in Quick Law and Westlaw. I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations for free resources for finding cases.
So there are a variety of different sources. I mean, you can actually, if you know that you're just interested in California cases, for example, you can go to the California Courts website and search them there. You can also use the LIE site, so the Legal Information Institute. So you know Canley. The original LIE site was at Cornell University. And, well, it still is. So theirs is simply called the Legal Information Institute. And so you can use that website if you want. There are other sources, and I can't even think of all their names right now. But there are other sources that have the names are just escaping me. Different cases. I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
That's okay.
Find Law. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of Find Law. So you can also use Find Law. Sorry. Findlaw.com and do your search on there. So there are different free websites as well, but Find Law is one. The LIE site is another.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on phone or in the room?
Well, if you do have any, my email is on the last slide, and my PowerPoint will be made available to all of you. You'll see I put screenshots in so that you can find the resources that I had that I was taking you to. And you can always just email me, especially if there's something tricky that you're looking for. You can email me, and I can see if I can help you find it.
Hi, Kim. It's Melanie Bickert here.
Hi, Melanie.
I did have a few questions for you. I'll try to be brief. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, you didn't mention the NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Yep.
Have you dealt with that at all? Do you have any, like, pros or cons on whether it's reliable or useful?
You know what? I have used it in the past when I was in California in particular. In fact, one of my librarians that I hired actually used to work there. It can be extremely helpful to find out what the different states' position is on different issues. So it can be extremely useful for that, to get an overview on your particular issue. I mean, let's say death penalty, for example, to see what the different states' position is on it. So yes, I treat it as quite authoritative. It's a nice summary overview of what the law is.
Would that be sort of similar to those 50 state surveys
yes.
that you mentioned?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think then my last question would just be, like, you focus a lot on Westlaw and Quick Law, which I completely understand. Do you ever find yourself using the newer sources like Ravel or Case Text or any of those kind of up-and-coming services?
So, no, I've never tried Ravel. I've never tried it, and I just recently, one of my colleagues, American colleagues, sent out an email saying, you know, what do you guys think about Ravel? And so there's this discussion where, you know, they're not quite sure. I'm a little hesitant to use the crowdsourcing. You know, it depends. I'm not sure how I feel about the crowdsourcing sources, legal research sources. I haven't played with them enough to know how accurate they are. And it's, you know, it's still relatively new. And, you know, so I'm not sure. I haven't used them enough, Melanie, to really know if I can trust them in terms of their accuracy. What do you think? Have you
used them? I was kind of curious if you are aware, like, as like other academic libraries? Because that's a thing, right? I mean, most places like don't subscribe, right?
Right.
Because it's just not that well used. I'm most interested in like their heat mapping idea, like where you can say this is the paragraph of this case that's cited the most often. You know,
right?
Which I like. I think Canley is capable of doing. They have sort of. There's hints in Canley Connects that somebody is tracking that. There is some algorithm that can do that, but they haven't rolled anything out. Do you know of anything similar within QuickLaw or Westlaw?
Well, no. There's nothing in terms that tells. So QuickLaw and Westlaw is not good in terms of. How are things being being cited unless it's simply was it listed, you know, like was it listed, but it doesn't look at it in any deeper ways, so it can't tell you why things were being cited. You know, I mean, it can't say it was being cited for this proposition or this one, or this paragraph is being cited the most, unfortunately. And I don't know if they'll ever go there. Quite frankly, are there any vendors on?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because I'm saying this because we have asked them to do other analysis. We want, citation analysis. We want to be able to know when our authors or our professors have been cited. And Hines tells us, you know, for each case, each article, it'll say this article is cited, you know, in these other articles within Hines Online. Westlaw and Lexis are not willing to invest the money. And I'm not sure if they would be willing to invest the money in heat mapping or anything else unless it was the firms coming forward and saying, you know, this is a requirement and we're willing to pay for it. But I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Fair enough. Any other questions? On the phone, last call. You can also type in that chat box, people on your computers.
Okay, well, I guess there aren't any other questions right now, but as Kim mentioned, if something comes up or if you have something pressing that you'd still like to ask her, she's provided her email address at the end of her presentation there. I guess with that, I'd like to thank everybody for attending today, and thank you so much to Kim for providing us with this informative and thorough presentation. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.